Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 829. Katie Levine.
Yes, so I got a couple things for the cork board.
It's all business with you. I just want to know how things are going.
Oh, things are great.
Okay, good.
Things
now
are
do the cork
great.
Board.
Okay. First of all, an artist in LA, Brandon Bird, has a new idea for our project where he will turn a sedan into a memorial for Jerry Orbach.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Isn't that great? You know how you always see the cars, especially in LA?
So
that are
timely,
just, like,
too.
Memorialized. Dude, everyone loves Jerry Orbach.
Listen, I love Orbach.
How can you not love Lenny Briscoe? Come on.
He is spectacular. Right? Oh, and Crimes and Misdemeanors, he was fucking flawless.
And he was the voice of, I forgot the name, but in Beauty and the Beast.
Right.
Which I found
Lumiere.
Out as an adult.
He
and
was
I was
the voice
like,
of Lumiere.
And I was like, holy
Wasn't he the
shit.
Voice of Lumiere?
Yeah, yeah. And he sang and he was great. Oh, I just love him.
Yeah, Jerry Orbach's fucking
but,
awesome.
So he wants to turn the sedan and he wants to get it all
I'm
painted
on board.
And he wants to look great.
How much does he want to raise for that?
So he needs to raise, let's see, $22,000.
Oh,
he
man.
Started a Kickstarter for it. There's 14 more days to go. If you just go to Kickstarter.com and you search Jerry Orbach, you'll find it.
You'll have to sift through all the other Jerry Orbach Kickstarters.
But
out
I
there.
Just, I love this idea and I really want it to, I really want it to happen. Also, I want to promote the Best Friends Strut Your Mutt event, and we have a team Nerdist.
Great.
And you guys can still sign up to be on the team. You can sign up to be on the team, and you don't even have to show up. You don't have to have a dog. You can just come there and pet dogs, or you can just donate to the team. But also, someone sent in this. It's a New Jersey's only zombie dog walk returns for its fourth year on October 22nd, the same day as Strut Your Mutt. To help raise money for local New Jersey animal shelters. It sounds like a really great time. They're going to have live music, food, a blood drive, animal adoptions, costume contest, Halloween pet photos, and the zombie dog walk. If you go to dogwalkofthedead.com, you can find out more info.
That's great. I think they also could have called it, Hey, I'm Walking Here.
Oh, and then for Strut Your Mutt, go to nerdi.st/strutyourmuttteam.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for that, and thank you for doing that, Katie.
I want people
episode,
to sign up.
I know. This episode is Sarah Jessica Parker, who was, she was great.
She was so great.
Oh, my God. You know,
she dresses so nice, and I felt like the worst slob in the world.
Me too. Me too. But she's just she just has such a great vibe about her.
Yeah.
I did not know what to expect at all because I haven't really seen her in interviews a lot.
She's
and I've
so down to
never
earth.
Met her and she was such a regular person, which yeah. I know sounds weird and I don't mean that to sound as condescending as it sounds, but I just didn't know.
No, it's a compliment. She was just cool. She was
yeah,
chill.
She was cool as shit. She's promoting Divorce, which is premiering, not the concept of divorce, the show Divorce. Premiering.
She's telling people to get divorced.
Enough already, all right? We got it. You were married. You're done. That's premiering on HBO Sunday, October 9th at 10 p.m., and it's also on HBO Go and HBO Now. Sarah Jessica Parker, thank you for being on the Nerdist Podcast. Here's the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 829, with Sarah Jessica Parker, Katie Levine. Please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How's it going?
It's going well.
This has already started, by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, no, I assumed as much.
Yeah, I didn't want to. Sometimes, there's sort of a running joke with people who listen where they're like, at what point is the person going to go, did we start yet? But I feel like sometimes maybe you should let people know just so that you know that you know.
Yes, no.
It is starting.
I'm comfortable even if it,
good.
If had you not shared that with me.
Why only do it because, I mean, I only kind of just ease into it because I think people are so used to doing, this isn't really like a press junket, and people are so used to doing radio interviews and stuff
right.
where you just automatically, your defenses go up because you're like, is someone going to fuck with me now?
Right,
or what's
right,
happening?
Right.
Are there inside right. jokes that I don't get?
Right,
or, you know.
Right.
But this is not a British gotcha type of program.
Right.
It's just a loose conversation.
Okay.
So, have you done a podcast before?
Yes, I have.
You have?
Yes, I have.
What'd
I mean,
do?
Oh, you mean I've been a visitor.
You've been
I've been a
visitor.
Guest. I've
yeah.
not ever conducted my own. No, 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 no. You don't want, I know it's a new institution, but you don't want me dabbling.
I feel
as
like,
as a person who sits where you sit.
I feel like people would. You
no,
must
no,
have
no,
amazing
no, no,
stories.
No, 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 no,
you've been, you've been in the theater. You've been in film. You've been in television.
Well, I might have stories, but I shouldn't.
You shouldn't tell them.
No. I mean, I shouldn't be. I don't know that I could want to.
Could want to do that? Yeah.
What you're doing?
Oh, sure.
Meaning,
sure.
I mean, I love conversations. I love conversations.
Oh, that's great.
No, I grew up. Primarily only listening to radio, only listening to conversations. We didn't have a television. We weren't allowed to have a television.
Oh.
So I grew up listening to NPR since it was a small station, like whatever our small NPR station was in Ohio, in southeastern Ohio. And if we didn't listen to the radio, we had to listen to records. So when I'm telling you, I am a person who's been raised on conversation, and it's the reason I love books is because mm-hmm. it's the most interesting thing. So the world of podcasts should be very appealing to me, but I also think that I think it has to become second nature to be the person that, do you pull it down, do you pull it up? If
sure.
I'm a listener, what am I doing? Pulling down or pulling up?
Right.
What? Which one?
So if
I'm a listener and I want to go to your show,
yeah.
I go to my thing, and do I pull it down or do I pull it up?
You'd pull it up.
Okay, thank you. My son's always correcting me. but meaning, I guess... I think that I am the perfect person to integrate podcasts into my life.
Of course.
I just haven't made the transition from relying upon my local NPR station
right.
to moving to curating my own.
Of course.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely makes sense. Was your parents' reasoning, was it an artistic reason? Like, television's junk, or were they like, it's satanic, or what was their reasoning?
It wasn't because of any religious or moral a principled position. It was, well, early it was just we couldn't afford a television.
Sure.
And ultimately they did think that there was things on television that weren't great. Like and by the time we got one, I think we had entered the age of, although Norman Lear was busy producing, the things that were great that I would try to get invited to my friend's house so that I could see, you know, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart,
right.
Carol Burnett, Sonny and Cher.
Mm-hmm.
We were allowed to watch, you know, Masterpiece Theater. We were allowed to watch I, Claudius, which I think is like
kids love
hilarious.
Who doesn't love
And I would be like, Mama,
Claudius
why
emphasis?
Is... His mom, why does his mom like him so much?
It feels like, are they,
yeah, I feel like maybe.
It seems like there's some, are they dating?
How come you
dating?
Never touch me like
That's
that?
So
oh, he's dating his mom.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is way better than other television.
So we were allowed to watch I, Claudius and the Olympics and Sonny and Cher. And yeah, and. If I had told my mother that I had seen the Mary Tyler Moore Show or Bob Newhart, she would not have been outraged. But she felt like radio offered so much. And records, you know, we just loved them, like Stan Freberg and, you know,
sure.
Nichols and May and all those early Bill Cosby records and Bob Newhart. And, like, that was a huge thing for us to – and then Saturday Night Live came on and my brothers were allowed to watch that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That is the at that time that was the polar opposite of that was a complete punk movement.
But that was good smart television.
Yeah.
So my mom was like, "Of course they can see that."
Oh, that's really cool.
Do you know what I mean?
I absolutely do because I think some parents would have said like, "No."
Mm.
You know, there's all sorts of off, you know, it's like.
But we were watching I, Claudius.
That's true.
So.
That's true.
You have to like
yeah,
remember
he's
the
to
environment.
Fuck the kid, you know, it's like, is this really that
yeah.
much worse?
And we were allowed to listen to like you know, Nichols and May and Stan Freberg, like, none of that was considered, like, like children's entertainment. Look, isn't she look gorgeous?
Amazing. You're not at all. Not at all.
You look so pretty, Ina.
Thank you.
What's going on, Ina?
God,
how
her skin
you?
Is so perfect, isn't
it's
it?
Not the first time I've joined the podcast.
Hi, Ina, your skin looks amazing.
Ina's going to become...
Look, Chris.
You look fantastic. And I feel like Ina's going to become like a recurring co-host of the show. A recurring co-host of the show. Because when Schwimmer was on, yeah. it came up that they had been friends in high school. Yeah.
Oh,
grade school.
Wow.
And then it all just sort of came back around. So she is known to the listener already, Ina.
That's nice. Well, maybe she should be a featured... I mean, maybe you should
talk to her. If Ina ever didn't care about her career anymore, she should do a podcast and just tell stories about people.
No, but wait, when you say do a podcast, do you mean she should have her own, or do you mean she should come here and you can be...
I mean, she should do her own. There's no way she doesn't have a year's worth of amazing stories.
Sure, but what about, why doesn't she just do yours? I mean, why doesn't she sit where I'm sitting?
You absolutely could.
I could be with...
What, Guillermo?
Guillermo.
You can be Guillermo. You just stand by the podcast door, and I'll just throw it to you.
Stand by the podcast door.
Is there a podcast door? I think it's great that your parents had such a, like, they really were trying to create a holistic entertainment experience, and that it wasn't just, because, you know, a lot of parents, even, I don't think anyone does that anymore, but even going up into the 90s, a lot of parents were like, no TV.
Yeah. TV was
bad,
the enemy.
TV's bad. And now I just feel like, oh, well.
TV's like an innocent bystander now.
Yeah, exactly.
TV's like, now I don't know, how bad do I look now, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, the internet is just an orgy of debauchery that makes television look.
My children don't watch television at all.
Oh, because they don't.
Not because we have the same rule in our home.
Right.
In fact, we don't, which is interesting too. Like, the deprivation, like the... You know, like when my mom would leave the house when we were little, we would all run to the TV and like turn it on and gather around and try to watch the things we'd heard about at school or in the hallways, you know, the Partridge Family or something that was mass, that was like people, you know,
right.
Our version of like water cooler conversation. And then, you know, we'd hear the car, and then we'd like turn it off and like run up to our bedrooms, and my mom would come in and she'd put her hand on the TV and there'd be like flames shooting out of it. It was so hot. She'd be like, Pippin Chubby Rachel Sarah. We'd be like, She'd be like, well, what are you watching? Who were you watching? You know.
Were your parents cool then when you started working in television?
Sort of. I mean, my mother didn't really want me to, but she liked Square Pegs. She thought Square Pegs was smart, really smart.
Square Pegs.
And Beats, you know, was, you know, her kind of, pedigree, her, you know, provenance from SNL was like very appealing to my mom. So that was okay. But she just assumed like it was like a moment, you know, like an event, like a thing I would dip into and then I would go back to working in the theater and or anything. Or I would do a movie and then I would do a play and then I would do a TV thing.
Which is what happened.
Right. And as long as I think she was just concerned, like, I would maybe settle there. And, like, that would be – and for her, she just wasn't entirely convinced that that would be the best, most interesting experience for me. But also at the time, I think she was very concerned because when we were out here for Square Pegs, there were a lot of kids that were working on television. And when we came upon them, she was concerned.
Well, they probably were not in the best shape.
Yeah, she felt like they were, that there was a kind of emphasis about them, like maybe that their value was like, that it was all wrapped up in that, and that there was a lifestyle that surrounded it that she, smartly, I'm grateful for, was like, she saw warning signs. Like, she was like, that can't be good.
Right.
You know, you should still be required to, like, load the dishwasher and babysit your brother and, you know, like, what she wanted, I think, was, like, a full life.
Right.
So she saw like cautionary tales that I think legitimately concerned her. And so I think that's also why she was concerned about me working in television, where there'd be like a huge amount of money and then you would be, you would like have a currency and then you would grow out of it. What happened when you weren't a cute thing and then you were this other thing? Maybe it wasn't cute. You know, what would become of you?
Yeah, that's very insightful, actually, from a lady from Ohio coming in and just sort of seeing all this and being able to see the matrix code behind the entertainment business. But at that, I feel like I remember chunks of the Square Peg theme song. Still, because I was exactly the right... That was coming out of your post-Fast Times era where it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, like, let's tell the stories of the kids who don't fit in.
Right.
And that was my group.
Right.
And so I completely...
Always the most interesting kids. In a way, of course. You know, yeah. Yeah, it was Square Peg, Square Peg, Square, Square... quite right, something like that.
That's
right?
Exactly what I remember.
Never quite right. Square peg, square peg, square. I don't want to wear my glasses. I have to wear my glasses. Square peg, square. Wait. It was the waitresses.
That was the waitresses.
That was the waitresses. I'm just remembering.
Love the waitresses.
And didn't we have Devo like on our show? I think we had Devo on our show.
I remember this. The guy, I wish I could remember his name, but the guy with the blonde rat tail.
Merritt Buttrick, who's passed away. Merritt Buttrick, he played Johnny Slash.
Yes.
Johnny Splash? No, Johnny Slash. It would be Slash.
That was
Splash,
that was the
right?
episode, because I remember him specifically saying Devo was his ninth favorite band.
Yeah.
It was like, Devo, they're my ninth favorite band.
Yeah.
Like, that was such a specific joke.
Yeah.
And then Devo was on
right.
the episode. And having Devo.
I think it. Wait, okay, I'm sure this is all wrong, but you're reminding me. I believe, was it possible that it was Muffy Tepperman's bat mitzvah? Party. I believe Muffy Tepperman.
I feel like that's very likely.
Played by Jamie Gertz. So beautifully
right.
played, humorously, amusingly played by Jamie Gertz. I believe. Is it pot? What, that would make her so young and we were so old. Oh, did she have a late bat mitzvah? Maybe something happened and I don't know. I'm sure there was a perfectly fine reason that Devo
was just appearing on the show. But that was a very progressive.
Yeah, that
move
was a really
for
show.
For a sitcom, like for a network sitcom, particularly at that time, to say like, hey, let's tell the story of the unpopular kids, and then we're gonna have this like alternative band Devo on. Like that was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, it was Ann Beats. You know, she had such a her worldview is so unique, and so that the show was just. I think the world through her eyes, you know.
Yeah.
It was everything she felt and experienced and everything she didn't get to say and everything she loved, you know, musically and artistically and even the sort of that chilly kind of humor, that kind of – I mean, it was so of its moment. I mean, it's very of the decade,
right.
You know. But she had such a special kind of surprisingly vulnerable voice too.
I was bummed when that show – went away because I really liked it.
Yeah, it was really good. But there were, I think there was too much activity on the set that was unrelated to producing a show.
There was? It was just
that's
like,
what I understood later. There were all sorts of allegations about behavior, unprofessional behavior. Maybe there were things. People included in their
you know bodies. Just things that my just thing that my young teenage mind just didn't understand didn't have the information to know. It was like, why are they ruining my life by taking away a show I like?
No, yeah.
Did your mom have a good sweetie, this business is mercurial and you have to
No, she was fine about it.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, and I went from doing that, I went to do Footloose, and while I was doing Footloose in Utah, I became what we called a major on the set of Square Pegs. I went from 17 to 18, so they burned my working papers as a celebration on the set, and then they put all the ashes in a Coke bottle.
Oh, that's sweet. Oh, you mean like
cocaine.
A cocaine bottle? Oh,
yeah.
Well, it was the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then framed it and gave it to me as my birthday gift. And so when I went off to do Footloose, I was by myself and I was like a young adult, like as I had always been in New York on my own because we didn't have child labor laws then. The labor laws only existed in California. So anyway, so I went off to do Footloose. And while I was doing Footloose, I got word that Square Pegs had been canceled. And I felt sad about it. I felt because I, I thought it was good. I felt sad. And I remember Dan Melnick, who was the producer of Footloose, who's like a big Hollywood legendary producer. He was like, no, this is good. This is really good for you. It's okay. You want to do other things.
Right.
This is like the best of all possible worlds. Happened. Like,
I mean, you went on to a huge movie. Footloose was epically huge.
Yeah, it was a big movie.
It's kind of fun to go back and watch it now. Like, well, there's a lot of dancing in that town. It was like, yeah. You know, like watching Kevin Bacon do the barn dance.
Can you believe how good he is?
He was great.
Isn't it amazing how good he was?
I think he could still do that.
Yeah.
I feel like he is the type of guy who, if someone gave him a compelling enough reason, he'd be like, all right. And then I feel like he would do it again.
Did he do it recently?
Did he do it recently for a commercial or something?
Something. He was standing next to somebody somewhere. And I think there has been a revisit. And I don't know how comprehensive a thing it was. But I think he's maybe... Somebody will know you with your typing fingers and you're pulling information up.
I want to say it's James Corden.
Did you do it with Corden?
I can't.
You know, there was a minute.
Yeah, but I'm sure he could.
There was a minute after you told the story about the celebration of turning 18 where I thought you were still going to say, and I was really worried someone was going to snort my working papers.
Oh. Like,
I was going to go, hey, look at all that cocaine.
Yeah. No, I didn't.
No,
I didn't know anybody was using drugs. I had no idea.
That's incredible for the 80s.
I'm being completely sincere. I had no idea that there were any. For years, I didn't know when people were doing drugs.
Yeah,
I had no freaking idea. I was like cleaning stuff up and I was like looking up the ceiling. Like, God.
All these razor blades. Who put all these.
I guess there's always like a layer of dust after new construction. So I'd be like, oh, I've heard tell, you know. Oh, I don't know why we would need that in this room. Let me find out who that belongs to. Never knew. I'm like, wow, your heart is racing.
Wow, you been like, did you sleep?
I'd be like, I just did about, you know, 20 push-ups. I was like, oh, my God, don't
incredible.
Work so hard. That's amazing. It's so late. I feel like you're not going to be able to sleep now.
I was totally that kid in high school, too. I did not.
I know.
I was such a straight arrow. Idea. I just didn't know what people were doing. What are you guys doing? All crowded around the bathroom stalls. What's in there? Like a nudie mag? Like, yeah. I just didn't know. You know, I was just very sheltered
nudie
kid.
Nudie mag. I remember one time my father brought me to a party. I was invited to a party in ninth grade. It was such a big deal. And he drove me to the party. And then when I got to the party, I saw a bunch of kids standing around a car outside the party, and they had a six-pack of beer on the hood of the car. And I was like, oh, geez, I don't think I should go to this party, Dad. And he was like, really? And I was like, I just don't think I should go to this party. And I was like, literally, we were like, drove past like a... one of those people in school, what are those, like snitches or like,
right.
Like, you know, I felt like I was like doing like work for the local police department.
Right.
I like slowed down,
take
turned
a look
around, mm-hmm. went right
You're
back.
Narc. You were a narc.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
what
you
I
were
was.
Narc.
But I went home and my dad was like, you know, I just want you to know if you ever want to try anything, you know, you can always do it here. Do it in the safety of our home. If you want to have a beer here. If you want to try pot.
Your parents sound really cool.
Yeah, but you know what, like, then they were, but they weren't. They're not cool. My parents aren't cool. And I mean, I'm not, this is not disparaging. They're not cool. They're not, I don't know why my stepfather was pretty young. He was younger, so I think it wasn't that far in his past that he could recall.
Oh, sure.
What it was. So he, but then I was like, well, I don't want to do that. I'll just not do it.
Right,
because I don't want to smoke pot with my dad. That like, for someone who just didn't ever even know what it was, or like, that would be the last, like, least. It's not romantic. It's not naughty. It's
and
not
also
like,
just watching your parents
subversive.
Get fucked up is weird.
And my mother would never. My mother didn't even have a drink of alcohol until fairly recently. And then she discovers, she's like, well, I like Riesling. I was like, Mommy, what are you, I couldn't believe, I was like, Mommy, are you drinking? She was like, I like Riesling. I was like, oh. Yeah, and I was like, do you like a Gewurztraminer? Like, I was like, you like an apricot flavored
You should say to her it's okay to do it as long as she's in the house with you.
Exactly.
If you want to do it here while I'm here, that's
fine.
Yeah,
no, we might. Yeah.
But don't.
No. You know, I was so, we were so excited. We, like, I don't know why, but we were so happy to see her drink.
But look, I mean, it's not, it's probably, when you start seeing those things, like hearing that story, like, well, you know, your mom gave you this kind of perspective and you didn't really fall into any of those traps. Like, well, of course you worked your whole life. Like, of course you didn't burn out in the 80s. Like, unfortunately, a lot of people did.
Yeah.
And were able to continue to work and do other stuff. Because, I mean, L.A. Story is one of those movies that I have to watch every so often. Because the longer that I live here, every time I watch it, I feel like, oh, I just got another joke that I didn't...
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even live here when I first saw it, and I still loved it. And now... And it still holds up.
Does it? I haven't seen it since it first came out.
The jokes still are appropriate.
He's such a good writer. He's such a good... He's such a keen observer, you know. Still, I mean, any of his writing, you know, the New York, any of that is, he's, Steve Martin's so good at observational humor. And yeah, like, I can't remember, I haven't seen it in so long, but at the time I thought, my God, this is so spot on. It's so funny. yeah.
Do you still remember the spelling of your name?
Wait, yes, is it big S, little, or is it little S, big A?
I think it's big S, little A.
Big S, little A, big, a little D, and big D, little E, big E, star with a little star.
Yeah.
I think she does it.
This is a little thing.
Yeah, like on his hand. On his hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still appropriate. Except now that girl would have a social media account. Like, it would be like, she would, it would be all Instagram, but that type, but that person, that sort of blissfully unaware, like, hey, everything, you know.
So, yeah, she was so happy. She was so content. That was such a great part. I mean, a perfectly written role. And I couldn't believe I got it. I mean, I auditioned a bunch to get it. And I think I screen tested a couple times even. And I loved doing that movie. I loved working with him. I mean, I had admired him for so long, you know. Obviously from SNL, but, you know, all of his physical comedy had always been like such a wonder to me. And when I got the part, I just went back and just looked at everything. I tried to imagine what he would want, you know, and that's why I decided to bounce all the time as Sandy, because I was like, well, you know, all of this is on the paper, but now what am I like? How will this be Steve Martin, Sandy?
Right.
You know, so, and then I just started bouncing. And then I remember at one point the director who I was so fond of him, Mick Jackson, he was like a real British. He'd come from like doing like really important television in London and long, big event miniseries of like, you know, the mine workers and like really. And then at one point he would just have a megaphone because we'd be doing big scenes and he was like, and Sarah, bounce. Like, he'd be like, action, and Sarah, bounce. And I'd just be like, great.
I thought about that girl. A few years ago, I dated someone. It was the same kind of situation. The girl was slightly younger than I should have been dating. And occasionally she would say meow after things. And in my head, all I could hear was like, big ass little A.
Meaning she would say like...
She would just go...
Oh my God, this food is so good. Meow.
Not even like in a sassy way. Just like in a kitty way. Like, meow. And I'm like, am I supposed to...
What were you like, at first, meow?
Meow? I kept trying to find that, like, the boundaries of it and what it meant. And one time I was like, oh, is this supposed to be a sexy thing? So I was like, oh, good kitty. But it didn't get any kind of response. Like, it didn't get any sort of a sexual response.
Meow, meow.
Yeah, it wasn't... So yeah. It was just like... I don't know what we're doing.
How funny. Did you ever say when you meow, should I meow?
Right. Or should I be a dog?
Should I be a mouse?
Or eat?
Yeah.
Are you chasing me or am I supposed to chase you?
Right.
Explained a lot why she would just run into the other room for no reason.
Yeah. Are you a hypoallergenic? I've got allergies.
Are you spayed? I don't know. What do I need?
Right. To, are you spayed is a very good question.
It's a very good question very in good today's. Question. Yeah. Have you had all your shots? Have you good? Yeah. It was just
so
strange,
odd.
Well, it was strange because I had been in long-term relationships for so long, and this was the first any kind of dating situation where I would call someone and then she would just text me back. And I'm like, why?
Oh, wow.
Does that mean you don't want to talk? Like,
right,
it's just
right.
Like, well, it's just the way people communicate.
Right.
Because
right.
I've been in relationships for so long that it kind of circumvented the whole advent
right.
of text culture.
Right. Like the transition in, like, yeah, learning that
yeah.
language.
And then eventually I decided maybe I should be dating people who are more age appropriate
right,
and
right.
in a better place in their but, life. Nothing wrong with her. Totally fine. She was
no,
very nice.
No, and if she's listening, you liked the time. You
it
enjoyed
fine.
It.
Yes,
and
it was fine. But I'm sure, you know, you look back and you have those moments where you're like, I don't, what was I? I knew that wasn't the thing I should be doing. I knew
I
it
know.
At the time.
But I feel like those are important experiences to have. And you know, anytime I ever, you know, am forced to, like, not give advice, but talk, like, when I'm talking here and listening to young people talk about, like, whether it's a romantic or professional life, I'm like, you should have experiences. You should date a lot of people. Like, this is the time because you can't go back. Really, you can't recreate a time when everything about your life allowed that.
Sure.
You know, and yeah, date someone who meow. Like, it's, don't regret it. And it's not like I was going to go to Mars. I made the choice between like a really interesting trip to outer space or dating the person that said meow.
Right.
So it's not like you're like,
I didn't
sacrifice so many
yeah.
other. So I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's funny later.
But it's hard. I feel like it's harder. I noticed it was sort of harder to date as I started to get older. Because when you're younger, I just feel like, oh, you know, you're on the move all the time. But then I feel like as I started to get older, like, oh, it just, you know, everything means more.
Yeah.
And so it was hard to kind of be like, oh, it doesn't matter if I don't hear from you for 3 days
right.
or it doesn't matter. You know, like I don't feel that way.
Right. I don't know how you're supposed to learn. That's why I do think that there's a time in a person's life where they allow, maybe without knowing, they allow from others what they do themselves, you
sure.
know? And then you get older and you're like, well, no, my time is kind of valuable. So now I'm going to really think about how I want to spend it because I can't get it back.
Right.
So now 6 or 7 years into my dating life, I'm thinking, well, because I could be going to a play tonight or being with friends that I really love or family members. So I'm going to carve this out and I'm giving it to you. So when you don't treat me well, it actually feels lousy.
Right, right.
You know, or because I liked you enough to say no to all those things in my life that I do like
mm-hmm.
in the hopes that maybe you'll become one of those other things in my life. And then it's just painful.
Right.
But that's like everything. I feel like the stakes just get higher in life.
Oh, yeah.
The older you are, the more you care about things, the more time you've invested in everything. It just, everything matters more.
Yeah, because when you're 24, you're just a time millionaire. Whereas like,
right.
oh, yeah, it doesn't matter. Who fucking cares?
Exactly.
You got all the runway in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and it obviously, when you feel that there might be a scarcity of something, then it becomes more precious
mm-hmm.
and you want to make sure that you pay more attention to it and foster it better. But I think that's good, though. I think that's good. I was actually, was it Neil Tyson? I don't know. I was having a conversation with someone about like how our personalities would change if we were immortal and time was disposable.
Wow.
And what types of choices we would make and how, and would we even really be able to survive technically, because you would just never be motivated, you know, would you never be motivated to do anything if you didn't feel.
I think it's so interesting. That would take, like, you would then, that would kind of separate the disciplined from the not. Like, you'd almost have to create. So, wait, my question about this is, if you're living in this reality where there's no, right?
Well, I think you can.
Do you know there was?
I think in this situation, you can be killed. You just don't naturally die.
Right. There's not like an order,
Right.
That thing.
Yes.
Right. So.
So I could be like, yeah, I dated this girl who meowed for like a century, and it wouldn't matter.
Right. But then here's the other thing. Okay, so if you know you can be killed,
yeah,
and other than that, you will just continue to live. Do you know there was a? Do you know this is? Do you think of this as unique? Like, are you of? Do you have information that there was a time,
right,
when there was time
that would change things?
Because then, if you are somebody who knows that, you might actually be able to be productive with your time, because you would might think like, well, you know, there was a time, guys, where you died.
Right.
So it'd just be so interesting to see, like, who's disciplined with all the freedom.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I just...
God, how weird. I don't know why I want that even. It sounds spooky.
It sounds spooky, but I think it also illustrates that it's important to know that you will lose things, because if you didn't, then it would just be like, eh.
Right.
Whatever.
I wonder how anything has value.
I don't know. I think that was our sticking point of like what would have value to you if it didn't seem like you could really lose anything.
Right. And what age are you?
Well, yeah, that's a good question too. I guess it depends on are you an immortal 80-year-old?
Right.
Or are you an immortal... Boy, this is the exact plot line of a Twilight Zone episode I watched the other night. Were you a Twilight Zone fan? No, because your parents didn't like
it. Yeah, I mean, later in life I would watch it. It's chilly. It's always left me a little chilly.
It's my favorite.
I know. It's really great. It's indisputably great. My brothers went crazy for it.
There's a guy who, he's lived for 2,000 years. He can be killed, but he's just kind of had this blessed existence where he... And so he's dating this woman, and her father's like 75 years old, and he's like, I want to be immortal too. And he's like, well, do you in this state? Is this really how
right,
you want
right,
to, you know? It's lonely.
And so how old is this guy? He's 2,000
years old. He's in his
30s.
Mid-40s.
Right, okay.
He's in his mid-40s. And mid-40s are like 50 or, you know. And the thing that he says is like, well, it's just very isolating. It's very lonely, and
right,
everyone else dies, but I don't die.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, and then he ultimately gets killed by an elderly lady that was his wife at one point. It was like, I'm not going to let you do this to anybody else, you see? And then she shoots him, and then he just turns into dust, and that's the end. Yeah. So, you know, it's got to have that great Twilight Zone twist at the end. Did you ever think you wanted to do more horror or sci-fi or
no,
kind of
no
weird
interest
stuff?
In it.
None.
Not as a viewer, as a reader. If you'd talked about that for much longer, I might have gone away. I mean, in my head, because there's so much I have to do today.
You just described high school for me.
I might have, like,
you
taken
just
care
described
of
if we had met at a party in high school.
I know I need to get done. I just never was drawn to it. I don't. I always was like, oh, everybody around me was reading, like, The Lord of the Rings. And I just found it, like, emotionally impossible. Like, I had no... Star Wars I saw because I was doing the Sound of Music on the road with my family, and we were in, I think, in Indiana when that movie opened, and it was so hot, and it was an air-conditioned theater, so I was like, yeah, I'll go, because it was, like,
sure.
Shelter, like, great. But I've never seen any of the other ones. I don't have any, if you ask, comic book movies or, you know, comic book villains and, you know, good versus evil. I don't know, none.
So how about this? How about, this is a podcast that you could do from this day forward. I'll just come describe these movies to you on the podcast.
Okay.
And then you can just drift off. And then it'll just be like your inner monologue of all the stuff you're thinking about while I'm explaining to you who Grand Moff Tarkin is or whoever.
Okay.
I think that'd be really fun.
Okay. That sounds great. That sounds like a very productive a way to get like a lot done.
You could get so much done in your head.
Yeah.
Well, am I correct in, did I understand this correctly that when Darren Star sent you Sex and City, you're like, I don't know if I want to do a television show. Like, were you worried about the, that feels like a bigger commitment than I want to, than I want to do?
Yeah, I mean, initially, I think I was less concerned initially than when it was actually going to be picked up. I mean, there were things that I was, like, thoughtful about when I first met with him. But he disavowed me of, like, any of that immediately. Like, any of that stuff, he just swiped right away. And I loved that part. I knew when I finished that script that it was good. Just the last moment alone, I was like, holy cow, there's a lot here. But then then I did the pilot and I just forgot about it. You know, it wasn't like I did a pilot for ABC and everyone's like, when are the upfronts and the thing? Right. And there's a schedule and everybody's like, you know, counting down to when you're going to hear from the network. That just didn't – I just did a pilot and went on. And then I ran into this woman on the street and she said to me, a woman I knew, and she was like, oh, I saw your show. And I was like, what show? She's like, Sex and the City. I was like, what? She's like, you did a pilot, right? And I was like, oh, right. Yeah, I did a pilot. And she's like, it's really good. And I was like, I have not seen it. I don't, all right. And I didn't see it. And then they told me it got picked up. And I was like, gosh, you know, I don't know if I want to do it. I was like, I'm concerned. I don't want to. I think I was just thought, oh, am I going to do this for 7 years? And then that's what it's going to be. And the last time I'd done a television series was out in Los Angeles. And then, you know, I drove on the lot every day. And then the guy was at the gate. And he was so nice. He'd be like, morning, Scotty. Morning, Sarah Jessica. And then I go to the thing. And I park my car. And I do the thing. And then I finish. And then I go back home. And then
too structured?
It just felt like someone was stepping on my chest. Like, sure. I was like, I think I lost oxygen in describing it. And I just was afraid. And then I talked to my agents and HBO at that time was so smart. They were like, well, what are you worried about? Like, tell us. And I was like, I'm worried about, you know, maybe it won't be, I won't want to always be here. And they were like, well, just, you know, and there were a couple other things. And we're like, well, let's talk about that and fix that. And let's fix that. And I was given like, there was nothing else to, there was no other objection. And so I went to the set the first day and I'll never forget, I walked to work that day because the location was really close to my house and it was at a Banana Republic on Bleecker and 6th Avenue. And I walked in and I think Timothy Oliphant was working that first day maybe. And I never looked back. It was, you know, 10, 12 of the greatest, happiest, most interesting, fulfilling, challenging, wonderful years of my entire life. And so I'm grateful to everybody around me who was like, simmer down now. Just hold on.
Well, the voice of the show, because initially it was a lot of confessionals.
Yeah.
Right? It
was like, we tried some stuff.
It's like people, was, like, people talking good. About their. So were you.
Like construction work, like Toxic yeah, Bachelor.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, what's wrong with objectifying women? I always find it, my friends and I dig it. And we find a lot of interesting women that way. Right, Bill? I was like, oh, they wanted me to talk to the camera and the pilot, too. And I was like, I only knew one man who'd ever talked well to a camera, and that was a man I happened to be married to. And I didn't want to try to
right.
do that. Like, I just am like, it's like improvising. You know, there are 6 people who do it well on camera as
actors. Oh, you're talking about Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Yeah, which started a whole trend.
They're like talking to, you know. But it's a really incredibly difficult thing to do. Like, it's really hard to do well. It's really hard to figure it out, make sense of it. It's a very peculiar thing, especially if you're like, I was like a legit actor, you know,
right.
my friend. And there was a fourth wall. And like our whole lives, you just don't break the fourth wall. And it felt like a conceit that was ill-conceived. And
right.
I could understand the narration, which even that, I was like, we have to be so thoughtful because then it looks like we didn't get our job done on camera, like we ran out of money.
Right.
So now we got to go back in there and be like, oh my God, what you didn't see.
It's not like in The Sound of Music you turn to the audience and go, I wonder how they're going to get out of Germany now. How are we going to get out of here, you guys?
Exactly. But they quickly saw that that was, we got we quickly got over me speaking to the camera, but the testimonials, those were a lot of the first season. I don't remember before how soon we rid ourselves of that. I don't remember. But yeah, we did that.
And did you feel pretty locked in right away? Like, I know who this character is, and I feel like, I mean, did you feel connected to her right away, or did it take a little time?
I never felt connected to her.
I'm always
like conjoined. I loved her. The more I played her, the more I understood her, the more I could learn lines easily because I knew what she would say.
Right.
Like it, but I never connected with her. I just loved her. Like a friend is really different than I am in every way. I always say the only thing that was the same, and now that this new character is like, we all look alike. That's the only thing that is the same between, like, Carrie Bradshaw and Sarah Jessica Parker look alike.
Right.
That's it. And we both have enormous affection for the city in which we live. That's it. But that's what I loved, was like, she was different. She was so different. Every choice she made, the life she led in that city that I love, how she lived in it, who she chose to live in with it, you know, within it, her relationship to money, to men, to friendships, to clothing, to reading, to indulgence, to debauchery, to bad behavior. Like, everything was different, which was, like, amazing.
Yeah.
Because basically someone saying to you, you are under contract to behave poorly, you know, to kiss all those men, smoke a lot, run around in clothing you would never have the courage to wear in your own life.
Right.
You know, make mistakes, but make big, grand, sweeping mistakes. Like, every gesture was big and luscious and, you know, fantastic.
But it was such a groundbreaking show in terms of, because I remember when it came out, and it's a show that if it had been four guys, people would be like, yeah, you know, yeah. But the fact that it was sort of making a statement of like, yeah, there's this sort of weird archetype in Hollywood for these types of stories. And we're going to kind of smash that and say, hey, we do this stuff too, yeah. And that's okay. You know, did you feel the weight of that as you got into the show at all?
No. I think we always felt so separate from any machinery. Like, it was still, you know, New York wasn't super busy then, and we were always kind of counter to the traditional schedule, shooting wise, broadcast wise, and we always felt, and sometimes to our detriment, that we were really outsiders and that we were, you know, not considered and rogue, and but there was some honor in that I think we actually secretly liked, you know, like, I don't know, we didn't listen to a lot of outside conversations about us. We really were just working so hard for so long, and we loved it. And I think the only thing that happened that kind of, like, penetrated in a way that changed things was, like, eventually it was just really hard. Although we didn't change us, it became very hard to shoot on the streets. Like, we would just,
sure,
there would just be hundreds and hundreds of people, literally every place we went. Like, blocks and police barricades, but you don't want to go inside because of that. You want it, like, the whole that show breathed so much,
right,
air of, you know, like, you had to be out in the streets, and it just became logistically incredibly complicated for us to get our trucks and our trailers and our crew in there, because before we would just pop in and out, we just, you know, shoot, move, and so I started, you know, you can't not recognize that there's this other thing.
Yeah, that's true. Your set is the city you live in.
Yeah.
Basically.
And you don't want to be absent from it and go interior, you know, like divorce. Like, we wanted to be interior a lot. Which, you know, we actually don't want it so much in the future because of time and environment and seasons. But So that, I think, played – it messed it didn't mess with me, but it was hard to concentrate. Like, you'd be on the set doing – some things were blithe and easy and souffle-like, you know, walk and talks with the, you know, with the ladies. But there were also, like, really – you know, the deeper we got into the show, the more complicated Carrie's life. You know, just constantly – just you know, paparazzi, hundreds of freaking paparazzi right at the lens because there was no laws, you know. Sure. So the lens, what you're meant to be walking toward often, as Carrie does, on either side is surrounded by paparazzi. Like, sometimes you'd say, like, please, guys, can you just not shoot while we're doing the scene where I'm screaming it big or tears are streaming down my – you know what I mean? Like,
right.
And spoiler, like, we want to keep this part of the plot, like – we had to shoot 2 and 3 different versions of the movie, the first movie,
God.
On the street. You know, like, make stuff up. Like, Michael was like, oh, I don't know. What I was like, I don't know. Maybe I'll this time. We'd have to, you know, just because we liked the idea of, like, don't read the last page first, you know?
And also, you can't take 2 steps without people telling you who is what character in their friend group.
Yeah, that part I like. I mean, that's nice. That's okay.
10, it was 12? 12 years? Is that counting the movies?
I think, yeah, we started in 92.
I mean, that...
97. We did, 97. Oh, I can't remember. Anybody? I don't know. I have no idea. We were on the air until 2002.
This is 98.
So we shot in 97. We started shooting in 97, and we did the last movie in 2010.
I mean, that's like keeping a band together.
Yeah.
Basically, which, you know, and these are like, that's a substantial chunk of your life. That is a substantial percentage of your lifetime. Yeah. So how did you feel you evolved, and how did the dynamic evolve through all that time? Because people change and people get, you know.
I mean, I think everybody changed in the way you're supposed to in that period of your life. Like, everybody was having experiences outside work that were changing them. People were having babies. People were getting married. People were getting divorced. And that's just, I'm talking about the on-camera people.
Right.
Never mind the crew whose lives were important to us, to me in particular. I mean, well, not me in particular, but I was on the set every day. So that crew, everything happened. I mean, as you know, you've been around people, you work with people, and, you know, I think we were... I would describe it. It's like much more even complicated than sisters. It's a completely other sort of man-made thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a lake that gets poured, and then the lake starts growing its own things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were a man-made sorority,
right?
That were allegedly very reliant on each other, on, like, that's our stories, right? Like, these were 4 women who were good friends, honor-bound friends, loved each other. So then at a point, like, you love them, and you don't always like them, but you always love them. You feel, you know, protective of what other people think about it and say about it. You know, it's a really long and big experience, and I think for the most part everybody kind of handled it well in their own way. I mean, it's hard to process. I think it's hard to process success, even small success. Like, you have to be equipped for it, and you have to understand it and put it in perspective and know where it lives and what it actually means, and that's a lot. But these were some fairly mature women who were luckily at a point in their lives where they could do it. But everybody does it differently. And it was interesting, I think, more than anything, to sort of, I mean, Ina knows because she was a big part of that, was like, why are you guys asking us about if we spent time together this weekend and you're not asking the guys at Sopranos?
Right.
Like, of course we didn't. We just spent 90 hours together. Of course we're not going to be together on the weekend because Cynthia has 3 children. And I have a son, or I have 8 siblings, and friends that I haven't seen outside work, dear friends of 20 and 30 years, you know? And why are you guys monitoring our off-camera? Why are you, you know?
Why do you think that was?
We are women. They just wanted it to be bad, nasty. They didn't want – because I think it's like this sort of age old, like Byzantine, I like fighting with, I don't know.
Right.
It was too hard to imagine that it was real, you know? And I don't know, it confounded me constantly. And then you like actually defend it. They're like, did you get, I was in Germany and they'd be like, did you buy her a Christmas present? And I was like, did I buy? I don't remember. No, actually, buy her a Christmas present.
Was this more than $500?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why do you give a shit?
I was like, actually, no. We're not together on Christmas.
So you hate each other?
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
What are you doing?
Wait a minute. You're making this impossible.
Well, it's all just tabloid. You know, it's like the tabloid thing to me is so comical because it's essentially a reality show that no one has technically agreed to.
right.
Where it's just this kind of like, well, if you get into this business and, you know, and people sort of treat you like, well, you can fucking complain about that. It means you're successful. What's your problem? Like, well, I'm still a person.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone wants to be represented falsely or manipulated.
Right.
That still doesn't.
And then
you know.
You're like, well, I remember these paparazzi. I was trying to have this really, like, really chill, very, like, deep conversation with them. And I was like, but, you know, these are my children and there's times it's appropriate. It's not. And I'm like, you're a celebrity. I was like, no, I'm actually. And not that it matters to you, but like when I became an actor, this did not exist. So number one, it didn't exist. And number two, I had no interest. I didn't become an actor to be famous. I became an actor because I saw really great actors around me and I wanted to be good enough to be among them. I wanted to be a working actor. Didn't want to be rich. Never thought about money. Didn't want to be a celebrity. I didn't know what a celebrity was. No one ever used the word celebrity. I guess I must have known the word famous, like maybe like the Olympic athletes, like, you know, Nadia Comaneci, it's like she was famous to me, or Olga Korbut, or, yeah, you know, the gentleman on the news, you know, I don't know, like, a politician was famous to me, a ballet dancer, but I never knew anybody who wanted to pursue a work to be famous, like, that wasn't, that, do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
So if I try to explain this to people, I'm like, well, no. They're like, well, you became an actor. I was like, no, you just have no frame of reference.
Right.
You have no interest or curiosity about the world prior to the last 7 years.
Right.
Like, trust me, there's a whole group of people who just want to do good work.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to complain about the fact that you have to take my picture on that, but, you know.
Well, but at a certain point, I don't think anyone likes being treated like a prop. I mean, you know, like, I think people do understand, well, this is part of the thing, and, you know, it means you're doing well and that people are interested in all that. But, you know, at the same time, I mean, that doesn't mean you should be denied humanity.
Right.
You know, like, hey, look, she looks really upset over there.
Or they put up
a picture where someone caught you mid-yawn. It's like, meltdown. You're like, I was just fucking yawning. It wasn't a
meltdown.
Where you're like, you know, because you're just like one. I mean, it's just that part of it just feels like, I don't know. That seems, I think if most people experienced it, I think they would go, oh, that's why that kind of sucks sometimes.
Yeah,
No one, on a very basic human level, no one wants to be misunderstood or no one wants to be misrepresented,
no matter
what you have.
And there are other little things about it that are interesting. Like if you come out of if you're in a women's bathroom, right, you wouldn't be, I don't think. But
would not be a good idea.
So, but then you would walk out of the stall and then there'd be a person that'd be like, can I have a picture? Like, you're like, well, I mean, I haven't even washed my, like it's so weird, you know? Or just other times that I'm sort of struck by, you know, and then a flight in the dawn and someone comes walking down the aisle and they lean down really close. I'm like, would you mind terribly if we took a picture? I mean, are you freaking, I mean, are you kidding me? Like, I haven't slept in days. I have a stitch of makeup on. I didn't bother covering a zit. Like, why? No, but I sometimes I think about it. Do you want your photograph taken right now?
Right.
Oh, no, those kids haven't slept in weeks. I was like, exactly.
Well,
when we both get sleep, let me know. And I owe you.
You fortunately have never been in a situation where you're at a urinal and a guy next to you is at a urinal like, hey, can I take a picture? I'm like,
maybe not.
First of all, don't even look at me right now because I can't finish what I'm doing until you look at me anymore.
Right.
And please don't talk to me right now. That's the only time where I'm like,
horrible.
horrible. Yeah,
that part's weird. But any other time, I'm totally, you know. But I think it's, you know, it is also a testament to you being really good at your job, where people do feel like, hey, I'm watching a documentary, or these are my friends. I'm just watching these home movies of my friends, and so they feel very comfortable. They're like, well, Carrie, you know, of course, you could go up to Carrie on the
like, and I want them to feel that I'm an approachable person, and I, you know, I feel like I am in great debt to a lot of the people that approach me in a way. Like, we have this exchange, and they gave a lot, you know, and so it's not a blanket resistance at all. It's just there are certain times, especially when I'm with my children, that I would prefer to just be their parent.
Yeah, protect them from it. Yeah. I think that's a fair...
Yeah.
I saw something in one of the tabloids that was so vile, it legitimately made me want to go in and like I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take...
Right.
But it was like comparing celebrity kids as fashion. It was like, oh, you can't... Yeah. Oh, that's... Oh God, it was almost ridiculous. Like, who wore it better? Like, was it Suri Cruz or this other... It's so vile.
Wow.
Like, don't...
Really?
And they're kids. They didn't choose
Totally. I forgot. I remember that Matthew came home. I don't remember when this was or how it was, because he never reads anything, but like apparently a bunch of people were making fun of our daughter's names, and I was like, what?
Why would you do that?
And I was like, why would you make fun? Who cares? Like, what? What? The names Tabitha and Loretta are so controversial. It's so outrageous. Like, how dare you?
Right.
How? I don't understand the world and the picture. This was 7 years ago. That was those were innocent times upon reflection.
Sure.
Like, we thought we had sunk as low as we possibly could.
Right.
And now it's like looking at the Bush ears. You're like, your head, like a beautiful, soft focus now. Like the good old days.
Is Matthew aware that there is a theory, and I feel like we need to take credit for it on this podcast.
Oh, wow.
Because it's from 6 years. I have a theory.
Yeah?
That Ferris Bueller does not exist. If you go back and watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off and imagine that he is Cameron Frye's Tyler Durden, that he is a projection of a person that Cameron Frye...
Wow, that's amazing.
...wants to be. It completely changes...
That's amazing.
It completely changes the movie.
Wow. Cameron is the great young actor. What's his name?
Edward Norton. What do you mean?
No. Cameron... Wait. You mean his friend in the movie,
Fight
Cameron?
Club. Yeah.
What's his... That great actor. Oh, he's so good.
Alan Ruck.
Alan Ruck.
Oh, you mean who plays Cameron? Yeah. Yes, that's Alan
Got
Ruck.
It.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So Cameron is... This is Cameron's story.
Cameron is Ed Norton from Fight Club, basically. And he's having this mental breakdown in the movie.
Oh, now you're way ahead of me. I don't know. I've never seen Fight Club.
Okay, so in Fight Club, Brett, and this is a spoiler alert, but if you haven't seen the movie in the last 20 years, fuck you. Not you. I mean the audience for getting mad at spoilers. Because they'll go, how could you spoil that? I'm like, because you've had 2 decades to watch it. Yeah, so, but in the movie, like, Edward Norton meets this guy, and it's Brad Pitt, and he's this sexy, mysterious guy, and he talks him into starting this club. Like, how do you know who you are unless you're getting a fight with someone? And so they start this fight club, and then Brad Pitt's character keeps spinning more and more out of control, and it takes him down this darker path, and then you find out that Brad Pitt never existed in the entire movie. He was a projection of Edward Norton's psyche, which kind of breaks in the movie. And so when you meet Cameron Frye, he's in his bed. He's a hypochondriac. He has an oppressive father. He's super fucked up. So I think Ferris Bueller does not actually exist.
I think it's amazing. And I will ask Matthew. I don't know that he's given it.
He's going to be like, what the fuck?
He's not mentioned it to me, but it's not like we talk a lot about.
Why would you be in bed and I'm like, hey, I don't think my character was real. Anyway.
Or that he would like be privy to any conversations about that might exist out in the world about, you know. But I will ask him and I will absolutely let you know. But I think that's really interesting. Like, actually really interesting.
It's just kind of a fun way
to
go back and watch
movies. It's just a fantasy because it's like, because it's creating the person that Cameron always couldn't be.
Who made you take out my car?
Right.
It was my friend.
Yeah, exactly.
My crazy friend.
Exactly.
He was perfect in every way.
Do you know Michael Patrick King?
We've met.
You're so much. Doesn't he remind you of Michael Patrick so much?
Really?
Oh, yeah, so much.
Yeah, I wouldn't really know each other very well, but we've met.
Interesting, that's surprising.
Yeah, we've absolutely met. Is it all the weird theories on pop culture?
No, because he doesn't have those theories. He has other theories about things, but not as much about pop culture. But I don't know what reminds me of. But I don't say that. I've never said that before.
This could be part of the podcast that we do in the future. I will bore the shit out of you with theories.
Okay, like that's fine, too.
Jessica Fletcher committed every murder in Murder, She Wrote. But that's an entirely separate.
Oh, that's really interesting, too.
Well, are you going to tell me that in a small town in Maine...
that many murders going on?
Yeah, in 12 or 15 seasons or whatever, it was like 400 murders this woman is just near?
Right.
The entire series is a reflect... It's just her in prison, and her narcissism can't cope with the fact that she's committed all the murders, so she's just pinning them on like, oh, Tom Bosley did it, or whatever, you know?
Right.
You know, so it's... Yeah, so she's... Yeah, she committed all the murders.
I used to wonder if Samantha, Charlotte, and Miranda were real, that wasn't just her column.
Oh, that blows
that it's
my
all,
mind.
All her column.
That blows my mind.
Because otherwise, because they're such perfectly archetypal characters, the
sure.
other three. So you're writing a column about sexual politics and, you know, observations of female primarily. Right, heterosexual relationship. So you're picking one type. You're saying like this type is this and this, and then you just complicate it more, like any good writer does. So I'm not entirely sure they're actually real.
Oh, that is fantastic. So are they mental projections of her, or are they just invented characters?
I think they're invented types, and that she is among them because that's her way of infiltrating story and affecting story too. So she also wants to have her own actions affect those friendships, affect their and document their response.
That is a spectacular way to go back and watch that many seasons of the show. None of them are. They're all
made up.
Do you think they're in her head, or it was just a literary tool to help her column? In other words, do you think she's
I think it's a literary conceit.
It's just a
conceit.
Literary thing. It's all literary conceit.
Yeah.
Where's Samantha? She'll be here. You just missed her. Where's Charlotte? Oh, she.
Well, we don't know if any of that stuff that happened is real.
Because she's just dictating.
She's just writing it. She just writes a column each week, right?
Oh, my God.
So we don't know. Then we illustrate it for the audience. We illustrate this column for the audience. We're not necessarily illustrating the column for the column. What we are seeing isn't necessarily what happened in New York City to real people that they were bumping into. That's
a
very well embroidered story.
I cannot wait to tell my mom that story, who legit named her cat Mr. Big. Legit. Named her, and she says it so sincerely. Well, I have to take Mr. Big. I'm like, would you please? You would just call the kid Chris Noth. Call the cat Chris Noth. Like, that would be fine.
That would be
but
sweet.
Mr. Big is just
God,
such a
hilarious.
Strange. Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Big, I have to get him fixed. He's meow. Okay, fine.
Meow.
Meow. Meow. Did I date this cat? I feel like I dated this cat. So what was the decision to go back to television for divorce?
Well, originally, about 4 years ago, I came to Allison Benson, sitting over there, my partner at Pretty Matches Productions. And she runs Pretty Matches. And I came to her, and I don't even remember the original conversation, but basically I just said, you know, I'm really interested in an affair, basically, and an affair in a marriage. And that I wanted very much to explore marriages working in all sorts of different ways. And that at a certain point in your life, you're experiencing a long-term relationship differently than you had in the beginning. And we were interested in it. HBO was very enthusiastic about this idea in general. And we sort of, as you do, went through various stages of development and thought we had something, and it just kind of never, as they say, it just like couldn't get across the footlights, you know, mm-hmm. like it just, but HBO, I'm thrilled, remained enthusiastic about the idea. And eventually they put us together with a few writers, one of whom was Sharon, and Allison and I went to meet Sharon Horgan. And at this point it had been made clear to me that there was the expectation that I would be in this. At at early on, I was just, we were just developing this as we do among many other things we're developing. And I wasn't, it wasn't for me. I was just interested in the story as a producer. So by the time we met Sharon, I was already assuming that I was going to play the part of the, you know, this, the female part of this couple telling the story. And we met Sharon and we were really excited about what she was interested in, and she was excited about the things that were of interest to us, and in particular she was really wanted to explore divorce, and we were, you know, very excited that that, that sort of that idea could integrate into the, you know, the areas that that I was just very curious about. And so she went off and she wrote the pilot, and we did it, and I think what happened is I couldn't say no to this story. I didn't imagine that I would be telling it. I just was so, I felt it was such interesting and important material. And by the time I was asked to consider, I didn't really want anyone else to have the opportunity. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't turn it over, because I felt, much like in the beginning with Sex and the City, that there's just so much to be said. It's so rich. It promises so much. And much like Sex and the City, everybody's story of their relationship is different in a marriage, you know. And your search for love, all of our, those are different. But I think even if Francis's story isn't yours, I think these themes of, you know, wanting to figure out who you are and reckoning and looking back and deciding about your future and having complicated relationships with adults, those are all things that I think are interesting and can be funny and amusing and painful. And I just decided I was willing to, you know, my family was comfortable with me being gone, and making this kind of investment in time and energy is, you know, it takes an enormous amount to do it, to produce television and produce it well. And I just thought, yeah, this is the one.
It's here. Interesting to hear you. It was almost like it's almost like you had this scientific approach. Like, I'm interested in exploring this idea, and you're using art to explore the scientific theory about what happens with these people. So mm-hmm. do you feel like you're actually learning? Are you learning mm-hmm. what you set out to learn throughout the process of the show?
I think we learned a lot about divorce that surprised us. I don't necessarily mean, you know, what the law dictates and the role the law plays in divorce, but I think the thing that surprised me most about divorce and is that I think we always think of divorce as this desire to be away from this other party, right? It's this, you are trying to untangle yourself. And what I discovered is you need the other person to get divorced. Like, it's the craziest thing in the world.
It's a team building exercise.
It is. Like, you need to find a way to communicate, to cooperate, to be civilized, to be decent, to be honorable, to be principled, and especially when you're factoring in children and finances. Now, maybe really, really rich people can get divorced without communicating, but for the majority of people in this country, and I'm sure other countries as well, people don't come equipped like experts at divorce. Most people do it once. It's really complicated. It's painful. It's difficult. It's costly. There is huge collateral damage. Some people come out of it triumphant. Some people feel like it's completely undid them. Some, the children are destroyed and it's impossible for them to recover, and relationships are, you know, forever fractured. And other people feel completely liberated and they're finally their best selves and their children are thriving. And the same with relationships and affairs, you know. People, we all know, I mean, you must know so many people who have contemplated affairs, had the affair. The affair didn't hurt the marriage. The affair did hurt the marriage. They're better for it. They're worse off. You know, their friends think they're unprincipled. Their friends rooted for them. Like, it's, there's so much when you are really in a deep, long-term relationship that is interesting and surprising. And I think when it's real people who are surrounded by what we assume is like a heroic middle class reality, which I say not in a demeaning way. I say it like with a huge amount of admiration for making it all work every day. It's really something different. So I guess what I've learned is that you need the other person. It really, it shocked me. And that smart people do stupid things all the time.
Oh, yeah, because emotions are dumb.
Yeah, and good parents become bad. Like, it's just so hard to do it right, you know? It asks a huge amount of people. And like I said, most people just aren't good at it because they've not done it before.
Well, I will watch your show with my brand new wife.
Oh, wow.
And I don't mean brand new like the latest one. I just mean like...
Recently married.
Recently married.
How long are you married?
What's the date today? A month? Five weeks?
Oh, wow.
5 weeks?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Should he watch?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honey, I think we should really watch a show. It's called Divorce.
No, I think it's good. It's just... It's like the literary fiction space. It's like that. Like, it's like a really well-told, like, Cheever wasn't absent when we were thinking about this in some way.
Right.
Even though it's not a 50s, you know.
But it's Thomas Hayden Church, right?
Thomas Hayden Church, who's unbelievable and everything he wanted to be, and Molly Shannon and Talia Balsam and Tracy Letts and everybody
and you.
I'm around a bit. Yeah. But everybody is just at their finest. I described it as like being on like the seniors golf tour. Like when you're playing with the best. Like everybody's just so freaking well oiled.
Right.
You know? So I'm very proud of it.
Well, I'm excited. It's October 9th?
9th. Now I'm freaked out. There's a debate that night. Is that the second debate? Come on.
But you know what, though? I'll tell you why you're... Listen.
Oy, oy, oy.
It doesn't matter because with HBO...
Right.
HBO, it doesn't matter because, first of all, it just doesn't matter if people watch at that exact moment. But also, you know, one of the things that HBO... One of the many things that HBO did beautifully was getting into the digital space years before everyone else really thought about doing it. I mean, they understood, like, hey, people don't have to watch us on a television. We just want them to watch our shows. So people will watch on HBO Go a debate, or HBO Now, or...
I'm conflicted myself.
Or they'll watch half of the debate and be like, this is painful, and then just...
I want to see fictional painful.
Rather watch a show about divorce than watching the debates.
Oh, my God.
So it's just going to be crazy. What are you reading? Is this your book?
I'm reading this. This is a new Herman Koch book. It's called Dear Mr. M. Do you know him?
I don't know him, no.
He's great. He's a Dutch author. He's really good. He's excellent. For any of your listeners, it's an excellent book. He wrote his last book that came out in the States was called The Dinner. It was very controversial. Do you know anybody?
Why was it controversial?
Oh, you read it, yeah. Because it was it looked at parenting and race relations. It was massive success in Europe before it came to the States. And he's just a writer that can really, he's a contemporary writer who can really just like touch on stuff, but move back from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of feelings and opinions about
it. Well, this is why you're a very well-rounded person. It's very hard for me to read fiction because I just feel like I need to be working. Like I always just feel
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But you should think of it as the necessary and well-earned teeny vacation so that you can create more. You have to allow yourself the time to not create so that you can observe and see and experience, and then you have more to offer when you're creating.
What you're saying is 100% true.
I don't know how to teach you to do that.
I would get 5 pages in that book and be like, what did I just read? Oh, I was thinking about work. You know
what I mean? Right.
Like,
well, you're young, so that's probably what you should be doing.
I'm not that young.
Well, you look really young.
I appreciate that. I'm not that. I appreciate that. I'm 22. Meow. I have so enjoyed chatting with you. It was so nice of you to come and do this. I was thrilled when your name came up. I was like, seriously, she wants to do the bio? That's fantastic. Like, I don't know. It was very nice.
Thank you for having me. It was such a completely enjoyable conversation.
I'm so happy to hear that. And also, you were in a sci-fi movie called Mars Attacks, which is a fucking great movie.
Oh, right. Yeah. Did I see it? I don't know if I saw it, but that I love doing.
It's great.
It was really fun.
It was basically just like because everyone in the movie is amazing.
It's crazy.
And it's just like this gorgeous play.
Yeah.
You know, it's very theatrical.
Yeah.
And everyone, you know.
It's just like so dialed. Like nothing is so heightened. It's so crazy. And it was so much fun. And yeah, I love doing it. It was nuts.
Well, I encourage people to watch Divorce.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Yes. Thank you. I do, too.
October 9th. And then, come back whenever you want.
Thank you.
And if you do come back, you can let us know if... You know what? I feel like telling someone about a movie they were in, like saying to Matthew, like, well, here's this Ferris wheel. He's going to be like, I don't care. Why would I care?
He'll be curious. He'll that's something he won't... I think he'll be...
How about that? Anyway,
yeah.
Hey, so maybe how about this? We can end the podcast with a piece of marriage advice. Maybe if you have any marriage advice,
I'm
you
so
can
loathe
throw.
To give advice.
Doesn't even have to be advice. Just even if it's an observation, that's still.
Let me think. That's so good. That's an excellent question. I don't know. I learned to like things I didn't think I would ever like because of my husband. Even something so little and meaningless as like Parmesan Reggiano. Like I did not care for it. I thought it tasted like baby vomit, and because I never had any but the kind that you shake out of the Kraft, you know. And he was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Just try it." And I was like, "I don't want to eat." But I thought, you know what? This is important to him.
Mm-hmm.
So and now I love Parmesan Reggiano.
See, that's a perfect bit of advice.
But also colors, like he would talk about colors and have ideas about literally about colors, like colors on a wall. And I was like, I never thought about colors. Or he's a whistler, and I wasn't really a whistler, but I love whistling now. Like there's things like you
stepping outside your comfort zone.
But also I think it's not just that. It's like really not just theoretically liking something that's different about somebody, but actually finding a way to integrate it. Like, is it possible?
Yeah.
That's fun.
That's a great...
Because that can last a lifetime.
That's a great... Listen, it's, you know, things are either in two states. They're either growing or mm-hmm. they're dying. And what a great way to continue your own personal evolution than to sort of grow with someone else. I think that's a great bit of advice.
And I think that's so cool. You're right, exactly. Like, marriage is this organism. It's just... Why I think it's interesting and why I want to do the show and why what you just said is true is that it's not – it's in a constant state of change. Like it just simply is. There's no period yet at the end of the sentence. Like there is no – it's a run-on sentence.
Right.
And it should be. And everything that means, like grammatically incorrect. Like prepositional phrase in the wrong place, like fights and thing, you know what I mean? And so it's good that you think of it that way. And I wish you a lot of adventure. And
well, I appreciate that.
And memories.
Well, because I think there's sort of this flawed idea that the marriage is, well, that's the goal line, and then that's it. You don't ever have to try again, or you don't. You know, it's just like, well, kick off the shoes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like it's sort of like the king of queensing of our country. It's like, oh, you just like, you know, you just kind of don't
and
give
now
a
you ignore.
Shit anymore. And then it's a cool, you know,
right,
it's like
right.
you ignore your partner. I'm like, well, right. no, it's everything, you know, everything needs to be cultivated.
Yeah, it's really nice to think the way you're thinking, I think. And that gives you a real shot at it.
Well, it's just because I waited until I was older to get married. If I were younger, that totally would. I don't think I would have had the capacity to appreciate that.
Right. And And so you guys have a real chance.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah Jessica Parker. To everyone, enjoy your burrito. The end. We did it.
Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels. She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels?
There are murders in all of the books.
That she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.